times.
We did too.
And there's the shortened version of that.
Okay, we are ready to rock and roll. So let's go ahead and have a word of prayer, and we will get started. Gracious Father, we're thankful for the evening. We're thankful for your word. We're thankful for the uniqueness of some of these passages that we consider, and we're thankful especially when we take the moment to look at Daniel and we see the prophecy in that book that is full of substance and is such a foundation for our understanding of future things. May your Spirit guide us as we study in these early historical materials, and we trust it will be a blessing. Well, thank you in Christ's name. Amen. Chapter 1 deals with the four Hebrew young men, and it deals with them as they are taken from Babylon, from royal family, carried by Nebuchadnezzar into the land of Babylon, placed in the house of the eunuchs, and were trained in the training of the Chaldeans. We met our fellow named Horse Nose here. That is the chief of the eunuchs. Ashpenaz is his name, and that's what his name meant. And so we met him, and wheeling and dealing between these authorities related to the house of the eunuchs. And you end up with this test of the four Hebrews. The four Hebrews that we become quite well acquainted with as we move on into the book. The Hebrew names were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. That's in verse 6. They gave them Babylonian names, Belteshazzar, and Shadrach, and Meshach, and Abednego, and you see that in verse 7. And so Daniel was the leader, and he determined in his heart that he wouldn't eat of the king's feet, a path bag, or the king's food. It's translated meat. There were a number of questions we talked about when we were there as to whether this food, he abstained from it because it wasn't kosher, or whether it wasn't healthy. We do know when he did get to primarily vegetables, a vegetarian kind of diet, and he didn't drink any of the king's alcoholic beverages or any other kind. So it's rather interesting when we understand that as we relate to it. Now, we're on page 4 in the notes, and we're on number 4, which leads us down to verse 7. We have Melzar putting his neck on the line, taking away the king's food, and we could have hurried our way out last time, but it's more fun to watch the war of the gods be won in the way this flows. As for these four children, as for these four born ones, it is the Hebrew equivalent to technon, it's the word yeled. These four, God gave them knowledge and skill in all the learning, in all learning and wisdom. He gave them a special kind of knowledge or capability to receive knowledge, and the ability to be objective or to be prudent. That's the meaning of our Hebrew root here as we look at it. And so God gave them something that they would not have had otherwise. And as he gave them, you have an exception clause here, and that is Daniel. Daniel had all that the other three Hebrew children had, but he had it better. Daniel had understanding in all visions, or in every vision and dreams. The word vision happens to be a singular, and as we understand, we're going to deal with dreams and visions in this book. And that's going to be very important. We go into a number of places where the plural visions is used, and he marks them with a special grammatical form. We're going to look in a number of places. So this is the first place in the book of Daniel where we have reference to visions and dreams. We will see them on down through. We have a lot of dreams in chapter 2. Until we get to verse 19, and you have the word vision, and in the verse 28, you have visions. And so we do have this thing of dreams and visions. Now let's be reminded of the difference between dreams and visions. And the first is a vision. It means your eyes are open and you are awake. And you are seeing something, whether those who are around you see it or not. And the best place to go to be reminded of this is back in Numbers chapter 24. And you have a vision that's given to Balaam. It seems like I've been here recently. Last night in evening school in Woodburn, we were working the Angel of Jehovah and started with Numbers, with Balaam and his vision. So we're in Numbers 24, and we have three verses, or a little packet of verses, that tell us what a vision is. And so it's better to use a biblical definition rather than to use a human definition in this matter. And so our first verse is 24:3, and he took up this his parable. The word parable here in Numbers 24 and verse 3 is the word that is the title of one of the books of the New Old Testament. That it's the title of the book of Proverbs. It's the word mashal. And so parable, they translate a parable, I guess it's okay, but it's the word that is identified as proverb. And so he lifted up a proverb and said, Balaam the son of Beor has said, the man who had his eyes open has said, if something happens, his eyes are open. The implication is it was something that he saw with his eyes open, and he could see it with some clarity. Now, down in verses 15 and 16 in Numbers 24, and he took up this mashal, this parable, and said, Balaam, the son of Beor, who hath said, and the man whose eyes are open hath said. So there's an open-close kind of situation here. In 16 it says, he has said, which heard the words of God, and knew the knowledge of the Most High, which saw the vision, which visioned the vision. The word saw is the same Hebrew root as visioned the vision of the Almighty, falling, and the AV says into a trance, but it says falling, but having his eyes open. So he falls into this, and they translate it trance, but it has this idea. He falls in underneath this capability of seeing this vision, and he sees Shaddai, the Almighty. And we could go chasing Shaddai and a lot of things there. Shaddai, by the way, was the original name they knew Jehovah by. And there's a place to go in order to understand that. But you see, when you're awake, but you're not sure where you're at, this thing of falling and being alert, being awake, having his eyes open. And so when you see a vision, you're awake. A dream, on the other hand, you're not awake. With a dream, you're asleep. And he uses a plural here of dreams at this point. Now in chapter 2 and verse 1, it says, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams. See, now we move into some dreams. And if you look down through here, you just see dreams all over the place till we get to 19. And so here, Daniel could receive visions, and he had dreams that were of significance. It wasn't some short circuit of the synapses that produced something weird. These dreams were something that God attached to parts of the synapses of the brain, and he was able to dream. And would learn revelation by way of dreams as well as visions. Verse 18 says, now at the end of the days that the king had said he should bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them before Nebuchadnezzar. So it seems he isolates these four. They must have been maybe the front of the line to prove how good a job this prince of the eunuchs had been. And how well he had done. And the king commanded, or communed with them, I say commanded, communed with them. It's one of the words for speak in the Aramaic here. And if the king speaks, it tends to be a command. He has the clout to make it work. But commune works just fine here in the AV. With them and among them all, that is all four of them, I mean all of the rest of them, was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and he uses their Hebrew names here. And we looked at those earlier when we got rolling earlier. Stood they before the face of the king. And so they were the ones that stood, like I say, in the front of the line. They were the ones, after having been examined, that had proven to be the best of the best in this matter. And so it was noticeable because it says in 20, and in all matters of wisdom and understanding, and the word wisdom is a... it could be translated wisdom of understanding. Some will do that. Some of you may have a center column in that matter. But in this matter of wisdom and understanding, or wisdom of understanding, the italics in the AV is because of that grammatical relationship, that the king inquired or sought of them, and he found them 10 times better than all of the magicians, and some like to translate this word magicians, necromancers. These were men who practiced sorcery related to the dead. The word necromancer, necros, is a word for dead, and many of your lexicons are going to take that direction. And astrologers. Now, we think of astrologers as those people who will examine the constellations and determine your future by the constellations, by the movement on the relationship of the stars. They want to know the minute you were born, a day you were born, where you were born on planet Earth, so they could determine what you were like. That's just the way, the world system happens to work this way. And it says they were 10 times better than all of these that were in all of his kingdom. The word realm has the idea of kingdom. And Daniel was even unto the first year of King Cyrus. And Cyrus was Medo-Persian. He began his reign in 538 B.C. And so the story here is that he went clear through the Babylonian Empire, and he tells us in the beginning here, to the beginning of the Medo-Persian Empire over the city of Babylon. And he plays a role in that, and we'll see that when we look at the handwriting on the wall where they offered to make whoever could interpret the many, many Tekel Upharsin writing on the wall and interpret it and determine interpret what it meant. And they said, you will be the third in the kingdom. Well, the kingdom fell that night, and Daniel became third in the kingdom under the Medes and the Persians. So it really was quite interesting when we see that. Now, when we look at verse 10, it says that these four Hebrews were 10 times better than any of the rest of those in the house of the eunuchs. It doesn't say that. It says than any in the realm. So here you have 10 to 1 in comparison. They were so, so much better than anybody. You know, the old geezers that hung around a while. I borrowed that vocabulary word, by the way, from Bob. anyway. anyway, the old people had been around. I mean, the best of the best. And they were 10 times better than them. Now, that sounds to me like somebody won the War of the Gods. Sounds to me like not only did Jehovah win over the Babylonian gods, but won over the gods of every other individual in the house of the eunuchs. Every other person who went to Babylon University for the king, they were more than 10 times better than any of them. So I'd like to score it 10-0, but I can't remember the scores always. So at the end of this round, it's 6-0. No room for extra points, because I can't keep track of the extra points either. Mm-hmm. So in the War of the Gods, Jehovah wins his first one. And so all of the gods of all of these nations that were submissive to Babylon and all of the gods of Babylon were defeated in this by what happens with these four Hebrew young men. And so that's the first round of the War of the Gods. Next round is in chapter 2. And so we have the Hebrew chillins in the diet in chapter 1. Chapter 2 is the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, and this dream is an image vision, or dream. And what happens in this, we are not permitted to know what the dream is. It's really a weird chapter because you go on and on and on and on, and you don't know what it is. And it's in here deliberately for us, and it was deliberately for them, and we'll see how that works. And so that brings us to letter B in Daniel chapter 2. It says, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, you have the third year of Jehoiakim listed in 1:1 of the book. And this is probably about 3 years later. Now, I better explain this. How can you have 3 years when it's the second year? Nebuchadnezzar was the son of a fellow named Nabonidus. He was a king. So his father was Nabonidus. And Nabonidus ruled for a period of time, and ultimately didn't like ruling. And he thought it'd be nice to go on vacation. And so what happened early? Now, Nebuchadnezzar had become the king of captain and the general of his army. He'd been involved in those invasions, which ultimately brought some of these. He'd gone clear to the border of Egypt. He had major military conquests. He was involved with items that are still listed in history between the major powers of his day. And what happened, his father, many wondered if he didn't have some kind of mental problem or had some kind of an illness. We don't have a record because these Babylonians were relatively primitive early. When God calls him, well, I guess we'll get there later, it's amazing that he can call him when he does. When this vision is interpreted, or the dream is interpreted, because he comes from really pretty lowly antecedents. And you don't have a big bunch of Babylonians. You do have kind of a scroungy bunch of ruffians before Nabonidus came, and Nabonidus wasn't totally all there. And so partway through what happened, Nabonidus selected Nebuchadnezzar to be a co-regent with him. They reign together. And so what happens is Papa goes off into the desert and vacations. You know, there's a resort down there where he can hang out. And he dies. He died out in the desert before, Nebuchadnezzar became a full-blown king. And so it's kind of an interesting history. It messes our numbers up a little to say the third year or second year and how it relates. And so this year comes, we can tell historically that this year is 604 B.C. In the first year, and early in that year of 605, there is a major historical event which swayed earthly powers, world powers at that time, and it's called the Battle of Carchemish. It took place in 605 B.C., and Nebuchadnezzar defeated Pharaoh of Egypt at Carchemish. And Carchemish is up north. It's kind of like the bend north of Lebanon. So it's up in that area. So you see the coast comes up and it starts to go over to Turkey. Carchemish is right near that curve. And so that was a battle, and Nebuchadnezzar, and so you had two armies that had no home field advantage. The two armies were playing a distance away from each other, and Nebuchadnezzar won rather heartily, and many did not expect that to happen. And so it's rather interesting when we think of some of these dates. Now, in the verse 2 goes on, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams. It seems like it's interesting. He had quite an interesting night of it. I don't know what he drank or ate before he went to bed, but he had a rough night and was having a series of rough nights. It says he dreamed dreams, two cognate forms, wherewith his spirit was troubled. His spirit, here you have human spirit. His spirit, he couldn't get it out of his head. And his sleep was from him. We're starting to speak in tongues.
It's a robot.
A robot. Okay. So he was having trouble sleeping. Now, it's kind of interesting if we read on down. I'll look down at 228. It says, and there is a God in heaven that reveals secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Thy dream and visions, plural, of thy head upon thy bed are these. And so he had this mixture. It's kind of interesting if you're dreaming and you wake up and you're still, something's going on. Something's happening. You're seeing something. And you can't get it out of your head. And this was a divine intervention in Nebuchadnezzar's mind. And so when we read verse 1, it gives us some sense. But I really think verse 28 helps us understand why he was having so much trouble. It was very difficult to delineate between what he was seeing in his dreams and what he was seeing in his visions. And you see that interesting mix here with this. And so I smile when I look, was from the word break from him, and the end of verse 1 is the word to be from him. Then the king commanded, and here I say you have one of the said words, and because he's a king, he can command that all of the magicians, these are conjurers and astrologers and sorcerers, and the Chaldeans, were to show the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. King was in a panic state. And I think one of the reasons that he was so concerned about himself and this dream was the focal point of the dream was the head of gold. And it was him. And he saw some interesting things when we see that. He was in a panic mode. He was in a position of awesome power. Very quickly, and with a lot of glory and with a lot of major projects that he was starting and had started. Babylon became a glorious city. Remember, one of the seven wonders of the world was in Babylon. What was it?
Hanging Gardens.
The Hanging Gardens. And that was not just a bunch of gardens with fountains. They were like zoological gardens as well. I believe that's where, when he started grazing in chapter 4, that he was out in those gardens and among the animals. And I'm not sure which animals he was with, but that's where he landed. And so here we are. He calls them in, and they came and they stand before the king. It's interesting, we saw that in chapter 1 of these other individuals, and they come and now they have an accountability. King said unto them, I've dreamed a dream. Again, he uses this term twice, once as a verb, once as a noun. And my spirit was troubled to know the dream. My spirit was agitated. It was, to use an old word, discomfited. But it was the idea. He was very shook up about what had happened. Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Aramaic. Syriac is a bad translation. It's Aramith. And this is in Syriac. No, it's in Aramaic. And so that's the word that is here. At this point, we leave the Hebrew language. If we're reading it in a text, it will go to Aramaic. And some people say, well, the letters are the same. Yeah, the Hebrew Bible has Aramaic letters. The block letters that we use in Hebrew are the old Aramaic letters. They took away the pictographic Hebrew early in their history. In fact, it's really interesting when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were dated, let's say, 200 BC or thereabouts, they found block Hebrew in the Daniel material. And they even had some of the other Hebrew in it, like Old English fonts on the computer. And so it's kind of interesting. The letters were different at the time of Daniel. The common one was the Aramaic letters.
Times New Roman by then, is that it?
Yeah. No, let's see. What was that? Comic Sans.
Comic Sans, that's why.
That's Don's.
Obvious reasons.
Yeah. Okay. And so now we're in an Aramaic section. I'm debating how we're going to go with this as far as what I want to give you. I have too much stuff on Daniel. A lot of things. I have a translation of the whole book of Daniel that I've done, and I've done the translating of the Aramaic too. And if we do that, for those who are on the line, if we do that, you can probably run that if you want my translation. I have two of them. I have one with the parsing and I have one without. So I have to make some decisions about that. You can imagine it's a couple of pages on that. And I've handed it out. Sometimes I don't. And so this is what I do when I'm in Woodburn. I suggest it. The next thing I know, I got a bunch of vultures up on the fence trying to get me.
Well, you ask for trouble. You're going to get it. You ask for it. You know it every time you ask for trouble down there.
Yeah, it's kind of hilarious. And the thing is, it's the way my mind works, because I can think of things I've done. So here is, what do they say? Now, these Chaldeans are the intelligentsia. I mean, these are the guys that were hobnobbing in Nebuchadnezzar's cabinet. They were his advisors. They were not only political advisors, they were also religious advisors. And they had their own special languages, we saw in chapter 1. And so what did they do with the king? You know, they're just like any other person in the world system. They say, "Oh, king, live forever." Okay. Yeah, polish the apple.
Yeah.
And make sure, you know, they're landed on the... I mean, if they hadn't said it, they probably would have been taken out and stoned. Yeah. So anyway, "Oh, king, tell thy servants... the dream." In fact, it's interesting. He says, "Tell to thy servants." It's very focused. "And we will show the interpretation. Tell us what you saw, and we'll tell you what it means." And so, yeah, I mean, so how could the king then know if it was right or wrong? And so they comment, and the first thing they say is, "Tell us a dream. We've got it. We're good at this." And they are thwarted. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the thing is certain from me." It's interesting, the AV translates it as "gone." It's better translated to be certain or to be sure. He knew exactly what. He didn't forget the dream. He didn't forget the vision. It's just a crummy translation in the AV that's confused a lot of people.
You don't think he was blowing smoke?
He was blowing smoke?
Yeah, and when he said it's gone from...
Well, he didn't say it's gone.
He
said, "I know what it is, okay, but you're going to have to tell me."
Yeah, yeah.
On it. I mean, he would really lay down the gauntlet.
Mm-hmm. So he said something like, "The thing is certain to me, or I know..."
Yeah, you can look this up, and they usually translate it "certain," or "sure." And that is, or of a surety, that idea. So he says, "I know it. If you will not cause to make known unto me the dream with the interpretation, you let me know the dream and the interpretation." There's an Old Testament word for hermeneutics. "You shall be cut in pieces. You shall be made pieces." So he's going to do a slow torture. Just cut them up a piece at a time. How he did it, where they did it, you know, where they started. Did they start on the little toe, little finger, the end of the nose? What did they, ear? You know, if you can't tell me, and if they couldn't tell him, if they were going to tell him or else, he just would slowly get rid of them. And the idea of cutting them in pieces, and your dynasty will be somewhat ruined. Hmm. And it says, and your houses where you live will be made a dunghill. Now, dunghill has a meaning, and that is the local sewage treatment plant. But in this case, this word is probably, I mean, has that implication, but was a dump for all refuse. And so it was a garbage dump mixed with the other. And so there were sanitation, was a sanitation system in Babylon under the in the era of Nebuchadnezzar that was, do we want to call it sanitation? I mean, you know, you had the ditches along the streets and that kind of thing, which was normal in that day on it. And so he says, your houses are just going to be where we just drain the gutters and dump the garbage. And nobody but nobody will want to live there. And so it's essentially, he says, you got to tell me or you're in big trouble and your whole family. Like you say, it ends any dynasty. You know, it kills the family tree in that matter. And so anything that happens from there on, you know, they're going to be a bunch of impoverished people in the land. I mean, their offspring will be. And they'll lose everything that they'd work for. And don't forget, these are the mucky mucks. These are the officers, as it were, in Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. Now, he does offer a good alternative in verse 6. In verse 6 says, but if you show me the dream and the interpretation of it, you will receive of me gifts and rewards. The word reward happens to be singular. The idea of a big reward, and great honor, therefore show me the dream and the interpretation thereof. Option 2 is better than option 1. And so prove that you are who you say you are. Prove that you are doing what I hired you for. I hired you to have a touch with the gods.
Does that suggest that this was early in his reign that this happened then, because he's testing him out, almost like the first time he's testing him, almost, it sounds like.
Well,
yes, or else he suspects that either it's the first time or else he suspects these guys are fakes.
Well, he's concerned if they're not fakes that they'll tell him the wrong thing. I mean, they won't tell him the real interpretation.
You think it's because he's got somebody to compare the fakes with, the real thing, Daniel and...
Yeah, but wait, well, Daniel's sitting off, one. Well, from chapter 1, you'd like to think you'd remember, but I don't think he did.
Wow.
I mean, look at the way God choreographs this. We'll see. Mm-hmm. Daniel, he's not in the front of all of this. I mean, Daniel tends to be in these places where they want to chop him to pieces and do that kind of thing, and he finds out after the fact, and that's what happens here. In this matter, I think he was in such a position in the kingdom that he was not present. Many believe he was in an ambassadorial kind of a trip somewhere for the king, because he only would take the best of the best to do that. It's not like our country. In that, a king wanted the best representation he had, not. And so, anyway, we can't avoid being a little political, I guess. So anyway, he says, and here you have something of a repetition in verse 8. He says, and the king answered and said, I know of a certainty that you would gain time. The idea is buy time. You want to buy time. Because you don't know. I know that's what you try to do. And so I know you're going to try to do that. And once again, Daniel is not present at this. And so he says, because you see the thing has gone from me. The word, I mean, see, you see that the thing, that this decree has gone from me, and you're going, the thing is not the dream. The thing here is this decree he's just given. It says, tell me, and you give me good, and you tell me what it was that I saw, and I'll know that I have some reliable interpretation. But if you can't tell me the dream accurately, you know, there's no guesswork here. You either told or not, and then he invented their interpretation. And so he this decree has gone out from him. And the word gone is another repetition of the word to be certain. But if you will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you, for you have prepared lying and corrupt words. Boy, talking about political individuals. It happened then, and he suspected it. So lying and corrupt words to speak to me are before my face till the time be changed. You're going to keep stretching it out until I forget. Now, I'm not going to forget, he says. It's going to happen. You're going to have to tell me. You can't put it off and put it off. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I will know that you can show me the interpretation thereof. I think it's really clear. The king knew the dream, and they didn't. And he knew that if they couldn't tell him the dream, they were absolutely unreliable to tell him what it meant. And so the Chaldeans answered before the king, and you can see they saw they were in a terrible spot. And they said, there is not a man, a human being. They use a word, and we have so much equivalency in Greek and Hebrew, in Hebrew and Aramaic, an enosh. A man, that manly man, upon the earth. Kind of funny the word they use for earth here. It's upon dry land. The implication there is kind of funny to me. There's not a person in dry land anywhere. There's dry land that can do this. It comes from a word to be dry or to waste that you all bash in Hebrew. That can show the king's matter. Let's translate it a little cleaner, because once again we have a can word that obscures the text. It says there's not a man that has the power or the ability to show. The word can is one of those marginal power words that has the ability to show, and it's isolated. The can is obscured in English. The king's matter. Therefore, there is no king, Lord, or ruler that asks such things of any magician or astrologer or Chaldean. It's not fair, king. You have no right to challenge our business. We know our stuff. So tell us what you dreamt. Well, if you know your stuff, you can tell me what I dreamt. You know, you see what he's doing, and they're concerned because they know they use other mechanisms. Even if they're, splitting up animals and reading the guts of the animal, which was one of the things they did. And no matter what, it was so subjective, you could have rolled a pair of dice and come up with a better option in many ways. And they say, and it is a rare thing. It is a difficult thing. It is a hard thing. Rare, it's an emphasis on it being difficult, on being hard. A hard thing that the king asks. And the word that's translated requireth in the King James is the normal word. Well, it's the same three radicals that is translated ask. And there is none other that can show it before the king except the gods. I thought you guys had access to the gods. I thought you could tap the gods. And they're admitting, essentially, they don't have direct access to the gods. He hired them for that purpose, but they didn't have it. And he says, except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. Those gods of what? These guys became agnostic real fast. The gods did something, and they ran away and left us. And they're trying to alibi their way out of it in every way to deny, to keep themselves alive. For this cause the king was angry and very furious. He was enraged, if you want to know what it actually means here. He was angry and enraged and commanded. And once again, when the king speaks, it becomes a command to destroy. And it's literally to cause to perish. It's a causative stem here. All of the wise men of Babylon, every one of them, he said, I'm going to cause you to perish. And the decree went forth that all the wise men should be slain. I like the word slain because it's one of the earliest Hebrew words, the verbs that I learned. Because when I learned the verb, I learned katal, which means to kill. And it occurs more often in the Aramaic sections in the Bible than it does in the Hebrew sections. And we learn our paradigm off of that from some grammars. So that they should be killed. And they sought Daniel and his fellows to kill him, to cause him to die, to cause to kill him. And so you can see they had to go find him somewhere. They weren't out there in that crowd. They had to go find him somewhere. Where were they? We don't know. Then Daniel, so they're out there, somebody's out there knocking the doors. Where are you at? Knocking on Daniel's door. And we're hustling him. And then Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard. So it seems he was in quarters where they housed the eunuchs that were in supervisory positions in the kingdom. And you have Arioch, the king's captain, or the chief of the king's guard. You want to know how this translates very nicely? The chief of the executioners. The chief of the executioners is the way that many translated executioners. Some translated bodyguards. So this guy was the one who was out to get him, which was gone forth to slay or to kill the wise men of Babylon. So he answered him, and he uses, there are two words here, counsel and wisdom. He used good judgment, and he says, I wasn't there. I had no idea this was going on. I wasn't at that meeting. How come I wasn't summoned? No, he didn't say that. And so he answered, and he said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree so hasty from the king? I don't know why the King James translates it hasty. It's translated urgent in
ASV.
It comes from a root idea of being harsh. I mean, it'd be fast and harsh. Just quick punishment. And so harsh. The Brown Diver Briggs translates it harsh, or gives that definition of harsh from the king there. And Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. So Arioch had to tell him the story so he would know why he was going to get killed. I mean, it's kind of interesting. He gives him this accounting. Then Daniel went and desired of the king, or from the king, or asked of the king. The word desire is one of the communication with God terms in the Old Testament. And it's not exactly like I tell, but it's on the edge of it when we look at the New Testament. So he asked of the king that he would give him time. He had just heard of it. And that he would show the king the interpretation. And so he had determined this was going to happen. Was rather interesting. It seems like he was almost impetuous when he does this. But he had faith in God, and we see that, you know, by faith. And so when Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions. Word companion means these who were bound together, probably in an office, in their work, that they would desire, and there again is the word ask, the AV translates it, desire, ask the tender compassions from before the God of the heavens. Monotheistic, one God. And he says, yeah, I would like to have you ask. Now, it's interesting, we don't know a lot about these young men. We assume they were from the tribe of Judah. If they were the tribe of Judah, they weren't Levites. If they were not Levites, they weren't sons of Aaron. So they were given an opportunity to communicate with God in a rare occurrence here. Daniel could because he was a prophet. It may be, and I'm postulating, that these also were prophets because of what God had done for them in chapter 1. But they are to communicate with God and to ask for the tender compassions of God. Anytime you see mercy in the Old Testament, it's not mercy. It doesn't match with the New Testament. This is the tender compassion. It's this gut feeling, as it were, of God, the God of the heavens, concerning this secret, that Daniel and his companions or fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. That's kind of an interesting statement, isn't it? They didn't care about the rest of them. They just wanted to save their necks. I mean, they didn't want to perish with the rest of them. And they had some kind of a way, because they must have been, I mean, they were not summoned. So there was some way that they were an exceptional group of four. Then was a secret revealed unto Daniel. Where? In a night vision. He had an overnight. He had a vision where he was awake. Then Daniel blessed the God of the heavens. He blessed, he spoke out a blessing. I smile because some will say he worshipped him. Blessing, he gave him credit for who he was in this matter. Daniel answered and said, and here he explains what he does, blessed is the name of God forever and ever and forever. This idea of it's interesting, the word blessed, being blessed, it happens to be a weird-looking form in Aramaic. If you hear much Israeli temple or synagogue music, you'll hear them say, Baruch Yivne HaGalil, Baruch, Baruch, Baruch. And Baruch is a passive participle of Barak, which is our word here. This is the Aramaic form. It doesn't sound like that, but it's also a passive participle. So being blessed, someone else blesses him, the name, the character of the God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his, and he changes the times and seasons. He changes the times and seasons. And this idea of changing is a good translation. It's kind of interesting. The form here, they didn't point it as a perfect verb. They point it as a participle. He continually changes, and that's an addition. I mean, it's not, they don't add a word there, but it's an, though it is a cause, he causes to change. We have a hofal participle, or hufal here, which is a causative passive. He changes what? The times and the seasons. He changes the times and seasons. We see seasons and times in the New Testament, in 1 Thessalonians 5:1 and Acts 1:7. When it talks about times, you remember in early Acts it talks about the times of restitution, and those refer to the millennial kingdom. And so he changes when he uses times later. It relates to God's divine rule. The kingdom of the heavens do rule, and we're going to see it in 4. The heavens do rule, and so he changes the times and the seasons, and we'll see it in 7:25 of Daniel. We'll see it in Revelation. We probably will go there in Daniel 7, Revelation chapter 12, where it describes the second coming and the tribulation period. It's backwards from what we see in the New Testament here. And he says he's the one continually changing, and he sets up kings. And he gives wisdom unto them that know understanding. He reveals the deep and secret things, or hidden things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and light dwelleth with him. I like that verse because it sounds like a passage that we have in the Psalms. I mean, light dwells with him. He has a garment of light. And so he's giving a kind of Old Testament worship here to God. And then he says, I thank him, or I thank thee, and praise thee. He uses two different words Both of them are very... quick aside, I keep talking about communication words. Daniel uses more communication words in a small package than any other Old Testament book. And it's not. This is not the most important one. We're going to come to the one when we get to 9, and you have a whole structure of different kinds of communication with God that are there. And you just hear, you have just 2 or 3. And one similar, this idea of thank. The funny part is that root has 3 possible meanings. That is, it can mean to be thankful, it can mean to confess, and it can mean to praise. And so they can mean those ways in the Hebrew text. And here we have another word that goes with it. And it would always be fun to teach a course in Old Testament communication with God, but since you're not there and you won't be using it like then, it would be have to be a class in contrasts. And I have a lot of material. I thought I could knock out a 200-page book on the subject of Old Testament communication, because it is totally different, or almost very little similarity between Old Testament communication with God and New Testament. I mean, like you have the word ask, and it's not iteo asking. Yeah, I mean, it's not you don't have that punctiliar action that's an iteo when you ask for yourself in that occasion. And so I'm mentioning that as we go through here. I'm dangling bait, I know, I'm sorry, because there's just so much fun here. I thought someday, I thought this, 40-some years ago, that someday I would write a set of books on communication with God, and they're not done. I have all these notes on it, and I figured I could do it in 1,200 pages. That is 200-page books for the whole subject. It's a big subject. And it's not like what you read about prayer. They don't seem to like to read the Bible. So anyway, that was an aside. He says, I thank thee, I praise thee. This is the word for praise here is not like hallelujah type praise. It's a little different term. It's Aramaic here. We do have a similar term in Hebrew. He says, O thou or to you, God of my fathers, who has given me wisdom and might and has made known to me what we desired from you, for thou hast made known unto us the king's matter. You've told us the king's matter, what the king has asked. And so we have the answer. We know both the dream and the interpretation. And so Daniel says, thanks, Arioch. He went in unto Arioch, whom the king had ordained to destroy, ordained sounds like they had an ordination service, who had appointed or numbered to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, destroy not the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show the king the interpretation. That was an interesting thing to say. He didn't say, I'm going in to tell him the dream. I'm going to tell him the interpretation. That was not presumption. He already knew what it was. And so he knew what the dream was, and I'll tell him the interpretation. And anybody who heard that said, okay, he knows what the dream is because he's going to give the interpretation. And so it's interesting what he leaves out here when he talks about this. As he was going in and planning to give him that, and he goes to the guy who's going to do all the damage. And so he says, don't let the others die. Okay, no wonder I had a problem because I went to the wrong column. And so he mentions this, and we're down in verse 25. And Arioch brought Daniel in before the king in haste. It was interesting. This is so close to the end of the line for all the wise men of Babylon. When it says in haste, that is an absolute understatement. In haste happens to be in a reflexive infinitive construct, hithpale, in alarm on his part. He was all shook up when he comes. I mean, here, at the last minute, here he comes, and here he drags Daniel with him, and he said thus unto him, I have found a man, and I like the word man. He uses gaver, which is a word for a strong man, a manly man of the captives, of the children or sons of the captivity of Judah, that will make known unto the king the interpretation. Now, he seems to be alibying the fact that he hadn't had him in the presence, or the king hadn't had him in the presence. He isolates him as one of those from Judah. And the king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, Art thou able, do you have the power to make known unto me the dream which I have seen and the interpretation thereof? And Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, The secret which the king hath demanded cannot the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers, show unto the king. But there is a God in the heavens that revealeth secrets and maketh known to King Nebuchadnezzar. And he begins to start an exposition, or exposure of what's going on. What will be in the latter days? The dream and the visions of thy bed, of thy head upon thy bed, are these, and we will continue at verse 29 next week. So that will be where we pick up, and that's on page 5, and we'll start on 4C number 2, and I can put a 13 in there. Okay, Father, may you continue to bless. We're grateful for the fact that the God we're reading about is our God. We're grateful, too, that as we see your work, that it's something that we can stop and realize that you do all things perfectly and do all things well. And we see it in the Old Testament, and we know you're just as reliable and more so in the New. And we appreciate it. May you guide us as we continue in study this evening. We're again thankful for this opportunity in Christ's name. Amen.
That's it.